So those are those two inevitable strategies for happiness, and they inevitably clash, right? And they're vividly depicted, the clash, in the classic movie Witness. You may have seen it. And in this movie, a young Amish woman, Rachel, falls in love with the decidedly non-Amish policeman, John Book. And Rachel's father, Eli, warns her that this romance is forbidden and that the elders of the church will have her punished. And he adds that she's acting like a child. "I will be the judge of that," Rachel retorts. "No," says Eli fiercely. "They, the elders, they will be the judge of that. And so will I if you shame me." "You shame yourself," Rachel replies, shaken yet proud as she walks away. So the person of moral compliance, of course, is Eli, her father. And he says, "I'm not going to do what I want, but I'm going to do what tradition in the community requires of me, and that's punish my daughter," right? And the person who's choosing self-discovery and hedonism, of course, is Rachel, and she's saying, "I'm the only one who can decide what is right or wrong for me. I'm going to live how I want and seek out pleasure however I want," right? So that they're clashing, inevitably. Now, of course, this room is filled not with movie characters, but real people with real lives. And, of course, we just don't neatly fit into categories. We're going to have personalities or family histories that predispose us to choosing one strategy or the other. Or we may try one strategy and then switch in a different season of our life. And the midlife crisis, of course, is the classic example. I remember a man, we'll call him Jack, sitting down in my office a number of years ago at St. Clement's after his father had died. And Jack was very successful on Bay Street, but he'd never received affirmation from his father for that success. And now his father was gone, and he realized that he didn't even enjoy the job that he'd poured himself into at a cost to his marriage and his children. He tried compliance, right? Compliance with his father's expectations. And he was done with that. And now he was going to leave the job behind, possibly also the marriage, to try self-discovery and hedonism. And he sort of decided to change strategies midlife. And others of us will mix and match every week. it's what real lives are like because they're messy. But if the scriptures are right, and both of these strategies ultimately don't work, what is it that Paul knows that we don't know? How can this hope-filled life develop? How can hope spring forth this Advent? Well, simply put, we can't, as I said at the beginning, earn or produce hope any more than we can earn or produce our eternal salvation. The door must be opened from the outside. Hope can only be given by the giver of all good things and can only be received by a humble and penitent heart. And knowing that there is nothing we can do to make God love us more, and there's nothing we can do to make God love us less, only that knowledge is strong enough to break the cycle of consumption, competition, professional emptiness. And a life of happiness seeking is actually still functioning out of fear, afraid that happiness will slip through our fingers if we don't have that one person or that one experience. We will no longer be happiness. So the inner workings of our heart need to be transformed by God's grace so that we can receive that gift of hope. And it seems to me that the opposite of hope is some sort of fear and anxiety. And we know that Jesus had some very strong words to say about fear and worry. "Who amongst you can add a single hour to your life by worrying?" Don't worry, says Jesus. And when Jesus said those words, he was speaking to people who actually had some really legitimate reasons to worry, to be anything but hopeful. You know, his ragtag group of followers, they now found themselves in a highly precarious financial situation. They'd left their jobs and families behind to follow Jesus. They had cause to be concerned. When were they next going to see their kids? I've often wondered about that. Where was their next meal coming from? And the Romans were beginning to take notice. And Jesus kind of kept slipping in these disconcerting side comments about persecution and death and suffering. But don't worry, says Jesus, don't worry. And while there can, of course, be legitimate reasons to worry, I think Jesus saw an inordinate fear and anxiety in his followers, and it was crowding out any space for hope. So he decided to address it. St. Augustine can be helpful here again. Augustine said that anxiety, which is what I'm positing as functionally the opposite of hope, he said anxiety is actually a really helpful thing. He says it tells you a lot about yourself. And he gave this great image that I love. He said your worries are like breadcrumbs sprinkled behind you. If you follow the breadcrumbs, you will find the things that enslave you. This is Augustine. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The gift of fear, fear is a gift, because fear is always born out of love, and we fear losing something that we love. Follow the breadcrumbs, says Augustine, because fear and anxiety are always the implosion of a false god. Let that sink in for a minute. Fear and anxiety are always the implosion of a false god. Augustine again. When something which is finite becomes our infinite, we fall from God's happiness. I love that. The idea that God has a happiness for me. It's very hopeful. But when something that's finite becomes infinite, we can fall from God's happiness. In other words, when good things become our one thing, the thing we think we have to have in order to be happy or professionally fulfilled, when good desires, and many of our desires are good, but when they become inordinate desires, we can become trapped by fear and worry, and then we lose them. And there's no time for hope. We're going to take some time for silence now. For some of you, you'll feel really comfortable in that. Others may squirm. But let's take some time for silence. And I want you to follow the breadcrumbs in your heart. Just, this is private. Think about what are the fears and anxieties that you have. Follow the breadcrumbs and ask yourself, is there something that has become an inordinate love in your life that's taking that place of God? So let's just take a minute or two, follow the breadcrumbs, and offer it up to our loving God. Amen. Spend our last few minutes just dwelling on hope. How does that door get opened from the outside? Well, I can only tell you what I have come to experience as true, reflecting on the scriptures. We need to be moved by the knowledge of the grace-filled heart of our God. That knowledge can slowly transform our hearts so that they are pointed towards the giver of true hope. Paul hints at this when he exhorts the Philippians. Whatever's pure, whatever's pleasing, whatever's commendable, think about these things. You may have seen the acclaimed foreign film Three Seasons about life in post-war Vietnam. In this movie, we meet Hai, a rickshaw driver, and Lan, a beautiful prostitute. Both have deep, unfulfilled desires, still searching for happiness. And Hai is in love with Lan, but she's out of his price range. And Lan lives in grinding poverty and longs to live in the beautiful world of the elegant hotels where she works, but in which she never spends the night. And she hopes that the money she earns will one day buy her the things that will bring her happiness. But then Hai, who's in love with Lan, wins a rickshaw race, and with the money that he wins, he takes Lan to the hotel, the most beautiful hotel in Hanoi. He pays for the night, and he pays her fee. Then, to the audience's shock, he tells her he just wants to watch her fall asleep. And he uses the power of his new wealth to purchase a place for her for one night in the normal world, to fulfill her desire to belong. And beautiful Lan initially finds such grace deeply troubling, thinking Han has done this to control her. But when it becomes apparent that he's using his power to serve her rather than use her, it begins to transform her and change her life. Jesus Christ, who had all the power in the world, sees us enslaved to the very things we think will bring us contentment. So he emptied himself of his glory and power at the cost of his own life, the giver of all contentment and joy. And knowing that he did this will transform us from the inside out, as Hai's selfless love did for Lan. It is the sacrificial, costly grace of Christ that opens that door to hope. When we see the beauty at the heart of God, when I think we realize that we've often been seeking contentment in doing the work of God rather than actually finding it in God. This is where Christians often get trapped, and professional Christians can get most trapped. We confuse the work of God with God's self. Our hope can be focused on executing the work of God well, rather than focused on the beautiful heart of our loving God. When that is at the center, then all our other contentments that we put our hope in become relativized, and they can no longer control us, and the loss of them can no longer crush us. The Jesuit priest who officiated at Philip Seymour Hoffman's funeral a few years ago was quoted on CNN saying this: Philip was a Catholic, and the sacraments aren't for perfect people, they're for the rest of us. When you come to the sacrament together at the cathedral, you're invited to tangibly taste the grace of God, not for perfect people, but for people with wide open eyes, knowing that life is lived on very thin ice for hungry, searching people who don't want to be controlled or crushed by the pleasures that we seek. Not for perfect people, but hope for the rest of us. Hope is a gift from the giver of all good things and can only be received by a humble and penitent heart. Hope-filled lives are only going to come from one place: our humble hearts reveling in the beautiful, grace-filled heart of our God. Augustine again, I'm a fan. Hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain as they are. Hope, a door opened from the outside, a gift to us from the giver of all good things. Hope can give us a vision of all that God calls us to, an assurance that God is living and active in the world. And so we're called to justice-filled anger at the desecration of our earth and the injustices at the heart of our political and economic systems. That's actually a function of hope. That's the Christian message that we bring to the work of justice, that it springs from hope. And hope also spawns courage, because we know the character of our God, who will never leave us or forsake us. So what is there to be afraid of? Hope is the only thing that spawns real courage in the face of injustice. In recent years, and particularly in the last year as a new bishop, I've come to appreciate more deeply the call of Jesus to cultivate our interior life. I'm an extrovert. This is a hard message. And that, in fact, for a follower of Christ, our interior life means even more than our exterior life. Because it is in our interior life that we are confronted by a holy God who calls us to rest our hope in God's character, revealed to us in the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. Hope only grows in our interior life, away from the pressures and strains of office politics, family dynamics, personal disappointments. So I'd encourage you this Advent season, like tonight, to create space for yourself, both physically, maybe in your home. Create a space for Advent waiting, a candle, an icon. And create some space mentally for that quiet and contemplation of your interior life, where that door can be opened from the outside, where you can dwell on the grace of God. And because of that grace, that love with truth, you can allow hope to grow in your heart. We'll end with just a moment of silence, and I'll close us in prayer. And yes, it's going to be Augustine again coming to the rescue. Let us pray.